I do think that we can encapsulate where we intend to stand in life by a single phrase, which I call life purpose statement. I think each of us can create a useful personal life purpose statement. And mine is a very simple one: do the next right thing.
What's up, everyone? You're listening to the Do Hard Things podcast by Elite SRS. The purpose of this show is to share stories of hardship and victory as an encouragement for those in the middle of their own hard thing. Because we know hardship produces perseverance, which produces character, which ultimately produces hope. Today's guest is Eric Maisel. Eric is an author of over 50 books, the pioneer in creativity coaching, and a world-renowned speaker. Eric shares his lifelong commitment to pushing against social norms and the importance of always doing the next right thing. He maintains that emotion must submit to conviction if we're to live a life of meaning and purpose. If you enjoy the show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a review so more people can be encouraged by the stories we share. Now here's the conversation with Eric Maisel. All right, Eric Maisel, welcome to the Do Hard Things podcast. I'm happy to have you and looking forward to hearing some of your wisdom, and would love to have you introduce yourself to folks. But I'll just ask a question for you, kind of tee it up. And the question is, when people ask you what you do, how do you answer that question?
At length, there isn't a short answer anymore. I think a lot of people have multiple jobs, multiple identities, and having trouble answering that. But I can tell you some of the things I do. I'm a creativity coach. Mm. I founded that profession maybe 30 or 35 years ago. I train creativity coaches. I work with clients around the world, creative and performing artists and would-be creative artists. I write books. I've written between 50 and 60 books. I've actually lost track.
Wow.
And I operated in an area called, sometimes it's called critical psychology or critical psychiatry or anti-psychiatry. And we're folks who dispute the current mental disorder paradigm, especially as it treats kids. Far too many kids getting labeled and getting drugged when they shouldn't be. So I do a ton of things. Probably the main ones are writing, coaching, and fighting.
Yeah, on behalf of others.
Yeah. Fighting on behalf of others.
So you said at the very beginning that you created the creativity profession. Now, when you say profession, do you mean like that didn't exist? You kind of created a brand new job for lots of different people that now has become a profession?
So we have to go back a long time into the 1990s. Coaching was not a big thing back then. No coaching was a big, I mean, football coaching or
sure, yeah, coaching,
but not life coaching. And so there wasn't a profession then. I was a licensed family therapist at that point. And I didn't believe in the model, so I wanted to get out of therapy. I didn't think I was diagnosing and treating. I thought I was doing something else. And so I called myself a creativity consultant first because coaching didn't really exist.
Yeah.
I coined the phrase creativity coach. This is, if you know the book, The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, this is about the same, the first books on the artist's life were coming out back then. Let's call it 1995 or somewhere in there. I'm not exactly sure of the dates.
Yeah.
My first book on that subject came out that year, the same year as The Artist's Way came out. It was called Staying Sane in the Arts. And so, yeah, I started a profession. There's a Creativity Coaching Association now. I train maybe 150 or 200 coaches a year in creativity coaching. We're out there all over the world working with creative performing artists. We're really life coaches for creatives. That's a simple way to say it. Anything that's up for a creative person, we claim we're able to tackle.
Yeah.
Whether marketplace stuff or resistance or whatever it is.
Wow. So when you say the word creative, or you say someone is a creative, can you define that for people who, just so that we're all on the same page as to what that is?
Not really. I mean, I can't get us all on the same page because it has multiple meanings. In the business world, it means problem solving and innovation. That's what they tend to mean by creating. It's a bottom line thing. Let's get this problem solved, or let's get a new product out.
Yeah.
For us, for creative people, that's not really the definition of creativity. It's more making use of our human resources. It's making use of ourselves. That's the way I would define it. So a lot of people are find it difficult to actually make use of themselves. They're usually stymied by lack of confidence or anxiety or something.
Yeah.
So to me, that's what creativity is. It's just one of our life purposes. It's one of the things that's important to us. Not the only thing. I'm not in that camp that believes that creativity is the super largest thing in the universe. It's just one of the things that makes us human. One of the things that's important.
Yeah. That's interesting to think about, because it almost requires the prerequisite for being a creative then would be self-aware of like what gifts or talents you have to be able to make use of them, right?
I don't know if it's self-aware or kind of a matter of luck sometimes. I think what happens is that a given child falls in love with something without knowing it, falls in love with reading. That's the kid who's off in the corner reading a book all day long, and other kids are out kicking a football and he's reading a book. That person's going to want to write a book at some point. It's just kind of natural. So, and if you fall in love with visual stuff, or if you fall in love with music or whatever, play acting, it's kind of natural that you're going to devote yourself to that without ever knowing how it happened exactly. So I don't know if it's a decision or kind of calling or a matter of luck. It's hard to know what to say about that. But for if a person has mere interest in a lot of stuff, they're almost never going to be very creative. What we're talking about is something above and beyond mere interest. It goes deeper than that.
Yeah. So there's a passion level.
Yeah. Pavarotti has a quote I like, the late Pavarotti. He said, "People say I'm disciplined, but it's not discipline. It's devotion. And there's a big difference." I think that's what we're talking about. Creative people are not more disciplined than the next. They're often very undisciplined, but they're devoted to something. They're devoted to the book they're working on, devoted to getting their, you know, screenplay written. They may be very undisciplined in their day-to-day life. As you may not want to look in their refrigerator or look at their apartment, but they're devoted to the thing they're working on.
Yeah. So when you look back before 1995, maybe let's go back even to 1985. So 10 years before that transition for you, would you have ever thought that this is what you're doing?
No, I'll go all the way back.
Okay.
I started out as a math and science kid. I thought I'd be in physics or astronomy. I went to a math and science high school in Manhattan called Stuyvesant. Till I was about 15 or 16, I thought science was it. Then it stopped feeling human to me. It's science. I revere science, but it didn't interest me at a certain point.
Yeah.
And I started out college young at 16. I had skipped a grade or something, and I was way too young. So by the age of 18, I'd flunked out of college.
Oh, no.
And this was 1965, height of the Vietnam War. Not a brilliant time to flunk out of college. So the next thing I did was enlist. And when I got out of the Army in 68, I had no idea what I was doing. So what do you do when you have no idea what you're doing? You get a degree in philosophy. So that's what I did. So I got a degree in philosophy. But at about the age of 24, I started writing fiction. I'd always loved fiction. I didn't know I was going to write fiction, but a novel came to me.
Yeah.
And through my 20s, I worked as a ghostwriter, and I actually lived by writing, which is very unusual for a young person. I could write a book in a month on anything. Give me a subject, you know, how to buy a rug or whatever it was. I could write a book on it. I was one of those people. But then we started having little kids and I wasn't making enough money. So that's when I retooled and became a licensed therapist. I had no idea about creativity coaching, but I did know that I wanted as a therapist to work with creatives. And I began to discern that there was no specialty, that no one else was doing that. They were not really looking at the issues of creative folks as a class, as a group. So I started doing that. I started giving presentations around the country as to what were artist issues and artist challenges. And then somewhere along the line in that time, as I say, I segued from therapy to coaching. And I've been doing that ever since.
So the creative side of you kind of came out when you started writing. And that was the vein that you stayed within from that point on, because it didn't sound like it was super present for you. You were very analytical until you took the philosophy degree, basically.
And I would say that's right. I would say that's true. I'll explain what I mean by wrote. I wrote my first book probably when I was 8 or 9. All it was, I had rheumatic fever as a kid. And the way it manifested itself was my left leg was paralyzed for a couple of months. So I had to be in bed for a couple of months, which I loved. I loved not going to school.
Yeah.
I didn't love being paralyzed, but I loved not going to school.
Right.
And so my mom got me this huge pile of National Geographic magazines to entertain me. And when I say I wrote a book, what I meant was I cut out different articles from all the National Geographics and put them together sort of as the story of life. My first book was ambitious. It was the story of life. whether that was creative or analytical, I don't know what that was, but I was already doing books.
Yeah, no kidding. Do you count that one in your
I total? Don't. I should.
Oh, you should.
I don't know what I called it. Probably the story of life.
I can't think of a better title. I think that was great. Yeah.
No.
So it was always kind of there, but not at the forefront. And then
that's
you
right.
Were able
I,
to
I really,
express
I really
it.
Did think it was science at that point. Science made sense to me.
Yeah.
I think I just liked big numbers. I liked the bigness of it. That's why I thought it would be astronomy. I liked, you know, that a light year was 4.3 trillion miles. That sounded cool. It sounds like a big number.
Sounds cool now.
Beyond that, I wasn't really interested.
Yeah. Mm. So talk a little bit about the third part of what you said you're doing, which is fighting for youth and the prescription or the prescribed way of treating them that's currently, I guess maybe mainstream is probably the best word for it. And why or how you got into that, because that's kind of how I got connected with you was through the book that you wrote about teens. And I'd just be curious to kind of shed some light on how you got to where you are, and then we can talk a little bit more about what it looks like. But
sure. I'll start way back. My brother, who was half a generation older than me, who was now deceased, did his PhD thesis at Yale on the recidivism rate of psychiatric patients. What that means is how often did psychiatric patients after they were released go back in. And I don't know the data of that, but that caught my attention. He was probably doing that in his 20s, and I was probably just a very young teen. There was something about that that made sense to me as an interesting subject. And also at the same time, my mom had three sisters. My mom was solid, and Aunt Rose was solid, and the other two sisters were off the deep end. One was off the deep end grandiosely. She thought she was Judy Garland, and she would perform in restaurants in Manhattan unasked.
Oh, wow.
And the other aunt was the depressed type, and she ended up at the Rockland State Asylum, where I would visit with my grandfather. I'd go to it's an upstate New York asylum, psychiatric asylum. We'd go on the train or the bus, I can't remember. So we had those interesting characters in the household.
Mm-hmm.
So I was interested in something about all of that early on. It was all mysterious to me, and I had no idea what it was about, but it was in my worldview. Then when I started retooling into therapy and taking classes like abnormal psychology and theories of personality and what have you, I immediately didn't believe what I was told. I instantly did not believe that you could diagnose a person on the basis of a symptom picture. I'm going to be a little technical here. I have to be, because it's technical stuff. But most of what diagnosing is in psychiatry is a certain kind of transaction. It's not real diagnosing. There are no tests, no blood tests, no any kind of tests. Psychiatrist is not medicine. It's not real medicine.
Yeah.
Here's what happens. You come in and you say you're depressed, and I say you're depressed. It's a transaction. I just repeat what you say, and then I prescribe you an antidepressant. No real medicine went on there. It's a very interesting game. I've done many whole books on this, so to say it briefly is hard.
Sure.
But Let me turn to children for a second. I'm right at this split second. I'm doing a book called Deconstructing ADHD. Everybody has ADHD now, right? Every adult, every child has ADHD now.
Yeah.
And it's a label for, to my mind, being bored, being restless, being anxious, having energy. It's a label for being an average human being of a certain sort, being a boy. It's a label for being a boy. And now, bizarrely enough, it's all the way down to preschoolers. You'd expect preschoolers to just sit quietly. No, you'd expect maybe they'd run around a bit.
Yeah.
To label them, and now they're starting to get these very bad gateway drugs to addiction, psychiatric drugs, kids. So it's hard to compress everything into a few sentences, but the standard model, which is encapsulated in what's called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, that's the diagnosing Bible of the world. If you're a master's level, it should strike people as funny when I say this. If you're just a master's level counselor, how do you diagnose a medical illness? Where do you get off? How is that plausible? Isn't that practicing medicine without a license? But no, every master's level therapist can say, oh, you've got the mental disorder of depression, or you've got the mental disorder of something.
Mm.
It's preposterous on the face of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's something that I've never given any thought to.
Exactly. And most people have not. And the collusion of mass media, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. It's just that all of these folks are on the same page. Mass media, academia, big pharma, research, the professions, all of them are on the same page because it's professionally expedient to the average time the psychiatrist spends with a new patient is 15 minutes.
Mm.
What could possibly go on in 15 minutes except a checklist? You can't conceptualize of what real thing could be going on between two human beings. I'm not going to be asking you questions in 15 minutes about your childhood or do you hate your job? Or I'm not going to be you have trouble sleeping. I'm going to ask you 19 questions and I'm going to check them off. And I know we're going to get to depression. We might as well have gotten there before we even started talking. But I know we're going to get to depression. I know I'm going to prescribe you an antidepressant.
Mm.
So it's a very bad system, but that's what we have.
So then talk about the other side or the other approach that you kind of gave three different labels to it earlier. I can't remember what they were.
Critical One psychology.
Was anti-something.
Critical yeah. psychology, critical psychiatry, and anti-psychiatry. They're all the same. They're all in the same place. They're really just different names for the same point of view that what's currently going on is not kosher. It's not okay. Mm. Really, an psychiatry is not a medical specialty. It's something else. And a lot of psychiatrists know that and will say it privately. Mm. But
yeah. So what's the solution? If there's a way to state it quickly, I don't know if there is, but what would be the path forward?
To start with not knowing. That'd be the path forward would be if you come in and say something to me, you come in with a presenting problem of some sort. And you might say, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, having trouble at work, not getting my novel written. I have no idea what's wrong with you yet. I have no idea what's going on yet.
Mm-hmm.
I need to inquire. I need to ask some good questions. And I have to keep not knowing until I know. I can't act suddenly like you suddenly say something and I go, oh, I got it. I've got the label. Thank God. Thank God you said the thing that got me right to the label. I want to stay not knowing. And then at some point, I want us to co-create some experiments in living. I want you to, if we've arrived someplace, let's say, I'll just make this up, but let's say you're a painter and you want to sell more paintings. That's where you've come in to me, to see me. And we have no idea what's going on. But it comes up that you, A, don't understand the marketplace, B, don't feel very confident, etc. You name the three or four or five normal things that are probably in the way.
Mm-hmm.
We pick a thing. Let's say confidence. We pick a thing. And then we'd say to ourselves, you and me, well, what would you like to do to get more confident? What would you like to try? What kind of experiment could we run? And then we might move to the place of, in this conversation, we might move to the place of, well, maybe you'd like to take a risk this week. It's going to feel risky. We're calling it a risk because it's going to feel risky. Mm-hmm. You're not going to enjoy this. But, you know, you might build your confidence by doing X. Maybe you should cold call a gallery owner this week. Oh, my God, I can't do that. And then we get to talk about the anxiety, the difficulties, maybe childhood, but maybe not childhood, maybe just it feels hard.
Right.
And your theme of doing things that feel hard, this, we're going to be talking about things that feel hard to you. Get a divorce, get a new job, whatever it is, they're all going to be hard things. It's not an easy thing we get to think of. We're not talking about the weather, which, by the way, is not necessarily easy either out there. But you know what I mean? We're not going to be talking about easy things. So we're going to try to create an experiment and then we'll monitor it. You'll go out and either take the risk or not. Probably you won't the first time. And you'll come back, you know, kind of disappointed and shamefaced and say, couldn't do it. Hmm. And you may give an excusey kind of thing, like I was so busy. Well, you might just say, I couldn't do it. And then we try again. Mm-hmm. Might reduce the scope. A natural thing I might ask you, is there a smaller risk to take? If you can't call a gallery owner, can you call one of your collectors? Or, in other words, just try the next experiment, just as you would in science. Maybe this is how science stayed in me over time, is the idea of running experiments.
Yeah.
Formulating a hypothesis. Well, it's about confidence. That's the hypothesis. Maybe it's about confidence. Let's run an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one kind of alternative to me quickly affixing a label and quickly giving you medication.
Yeah. Yeah. It just takes a little bit, well, probably a lot bit more time, but it's relational and intentional and thoughtful and nuanced, like people are, right?
That's exactly right.
Mm. I appreciate that perspective. I think, you know, that the medical field in general is, and I don't have strong opinions on this stuff, but my general perspective is that the medical field in general is more and more that way of a checklist and less relationship. And like, so the transactions on this side, relationships on this side, and the medical field in general has come all the way over to.
I think that's right. And it's difficult to talk to the general public about this because there is so much about medicine to love and revere.
Yeah.
This is not an anti-medicine stance at all. It's an anti-psychiatry stance. It's an anti a certain way, a certain one particular piece of the territory is not working correctly.
Yeah. And I certainly, yeah, I think that's a good point that it's not an anti-medicine thing. Like medicine is a huge gift for us, especially in this country, right? The access that we have to the things that we do are not available to many people in the world. And save lots of lives and do lots of good.
Yep, and it's where science has done its, you know, best work to, you know, clean up drinking water that doubled our lifespan. And, you know, the things that science can do, understanding what a virus is or understanding what bacteria are, this is all great stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you have to end up being one of the troubles with this world that I'm in is that there's no slogan. You have to be nuanced. There's no slogan. Nietzsche got so lucky when he got to say God is dead. Is that a great slogan? You know, three words that say a lot. The critical psychology world has no three words that say enough. One kind of slogan is childhood is not a disease, but that doesn't register. You know, it's a nice phrase, but unless you kind of understand the backstory, you don't really know what that means.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're a little at a loss for our talking points.
Yeah. Yes. They need some more creatives to come in and get some good slogans in place.
That's right.
If you enjoy the podcast, please do us a favor and head to your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review. It helps a ton. And there's a reason all the podcasts you listen to ask you to do this. We want to continue to encourage people in the middle of their difficult seasons, and your ratings help boost our podcast visibility and the stories of our guests. Did you pause it and leave a review? If so, thank you. All right. Back to our conversation. So the purpose of this podcast, you were touching on it, is it's called the Do Hard Things podcast. And the purpose of it is to be an encouragement to people who are in the middle of their own hard season. And the way that we decided to go about that was to share people's stories of their own difficult seasons and what came from those. To one, provide perspective that, this will end and there's something that will come from whatever season you're in. And two, to give some hope that there's good that will come on the other side. Because I think it's hard to remove yourself far enough from whatever situation you find yourself in to have perspective or hope in the middle of it. But people's stories are a great way for that to happen. And so the question that we arrived at to try to elicit some of those stories from folks is, what is the hardest thing in your life you wouldn't take back?
I was, of course, aware of the question. I was thinking about it. And what I'm going to say doesn't exactly fit, because it has not really been hard for me to be a lifelong resistance fighter, except that it's naturally hard to be that person, but I wouldn't trade it in for another identity. So I was born right after World War II, thereabouts. And World War II was the most important thing in the neighborhood. In the Brooklyn I was growing up in, there were concentration camp survivors. There were folks with the tattoos stenciled on their forearms. That was the world. It was a Jewish-Italian neighborhood, perfectly coexisting neighborhood, by the way. Jewish-Italian neighborhood. And World War II was on everybody's mind. It was on my mind. And that phrase resistance fighter was very up for me. And many of the fathers of my friends, this was left-wing, sort of Marxist, communist Brooklyn back in the day. And many of the fathers of my friends had been in the Lincoln Brigade, which nobody remembers anymore, but the Lincoln Brigade was a group of American volunteers, often a lot of New York Jews, volunteers, who fought against Franco in the Spanish Civil War prior to World War II. So I had that whole zeitgeist going on around me of real resistance fighters.
Yeah.
And parenthetically, early on, this is an early memory. As I say, it was a Jewish-Italian neighborhood, but we have to refine that a little bit, because it was both an Orthodox and an assimilated Jewish neighborhood. And it's not that the Orthodox Jews and the assimilated Jews fought, they just were unfriendly to each other.
Okay.
Not unlike Israel today.
Sure.
They coexist, but they have very different worldviews, and one does not trust the other.
Yeah.
And I was an assimilated Jew. And I really disliked God talk. I thought that was a betrayal of our common humanity. Just did not like it at all, whether from the Catholic kids or the Jewish kids. Didn't matter. Any dogma, any God stuff annoyed me. And so when the Jews would go to shul on Friday evening, or the Catholics would go to church on Sunday morning, it was all the same to me. I hated it. I thought that a lot of the world's misery, and I was already beginning to become acquainted with, atheist Mussolini acting like a believer, because believers are so easy to recruit into fascism, just like today. So I was already taking my oppositional stance very early on.
So how old were you at this point that you're describing?
I think I was as early as 6 or 7 or 8 or 9. For instance, standard belief system is good to have two parents. I didn't believe that for a second. I thought that the dads of my friends were bullies, almost all of them. And I grew up with my mom alone, and I was so grateful to not have a dad. So even in that place, I was not resistant, but I just wasn't buying received wisdom of the culture of the community.
Yeah, a really critical mind, sounds like, for critical a young mind person.
And just everything so much felt like humbug. It's like, no, I don't believe that. Just does not seem like the story that's always resonated the most for me in human history is the little boy and the naked emperor, you know, the emperor's new clothes. That was, I keep pointing my finger, ain't got no clothes on. Sorry, but ain't got no clothes on. So that started early on. It was harder to be this person when I enlisted, but even in the army, I was this person. And there's only so much opposition you can pull off in the military. But I would still try my best to put officers in their place, so to speak, by saying, you have to say sir first, but then whatever you say after that, you can kind of say.
Sure.
And I have anecdotes around that, but it was interesting to remain oppositional in the military. And then, you know, I'm an activist atheist. I wrote a book called The Atheist Way. I continue to believe that religion is a betrayal of our common humanity. I continue to believe that. And that it's a resting place. Do we think Trump is religious, but he, quote, goes to church? Come on. You know, I can't, not a bit of me, but it's a place of cover. Almost every fascist has taken that as a place of cover, religion. So at any rate, you can tell my positions.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an activist atheist, an activist critical psychology, critical psychiatry person. And I think these stances are important, even if no one stands with me, that's irrelevant to me. I have to, let me tell you one little anecdote, if I may, just in this area. There was a point some years ago, because I'd been pissing off psychologists and psychiatrists for some time. And at some point I was calling what I was doing, what I was writing about, natural psychology. Just a phrase I adopted.
Yeah.
And so I get this registered letter from American Psychological Association, not the American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, threatening me with a civil and criminal action for using the phrase, claiming that they owned the word psychology, which is completely Kafkaesque. Who gets to own the word psychology?
I guess they do if they want to, right?
I guess
they act large enough.
So I have a friend who's a federal prosecutor, and I gave him a ring and I said, what should I make of this? And he said, well, you've pissed somebody off, and this is bureaucratic overreach, and at the end of a many-year trial, you would win, but don't go down that road. Not fight this.
Yeah.
Not worth it. So then I had the interesting experience of trying to take the phrase natural psychology down from cyberspace. Can you imagine trying to remove a phrase? I had to go right to websites where it was being used and say, could you please remove it so I'm not in trouble? It's a crazy moment.
Yeah.
But this is one of those. This is the way whistleblowing is rewarded.
Yeah, we had Steve Magnus is an author. He wrote the book Do Hard Things, and he was a guest a couple of weeks back. And his story was about whistleblowing, and with Nike running, and it was, you know, not an enjoyable experience for him either. So I think there's quite the opposition in that experience that goes unnoticed.
You have to feel like it makes some sense to put the world on your shoulders to do this. Just, you have to have some philosophy of life, some worldview where you've taken it upon yourself to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the conviction has to be greater than the opposition, right?
Yeah. You know, when I first, I'd gotten the undergraduate degree in philosophy, then I'd gotten a master's in creative writing somewhere along the line. Then when I wanted to be a therapist, I retooled and went all the way back and got a second undergraduate degree in psychology before getting advanced degrees. And in taking that psychology degree, I began to get acquainted with the social psychology literature, which is wonderful. It's interesting. Most of the experiments the social psychologists ran can't be run nowadays because they're considered unethical, that the subjects experience too much pain from the experiments, meaning that the experiments worked too well.
Hmm.
Most famous experiment of its era, and the one that struck me the most, was the Stanley Milgram experiment that some people know. It's probably receding in memory, but it was called a learning experiment. But what it was about was the idea of having a teacher and a learner separated by plexiglass, and they're connected by stuff that looks like electrical apparatus. It's not for real, but it looks like it.
Yeah.
And the teacher is given the job, and this is done typically at a big university. It was done at Yale, different universities. Subjects were recruited, they're paid to come as teachers. And the teacher was told, whenever the learner gives an incorrect answer, just give them a little shock. And they had a little shock meter, you know?
Yeah.
Just 20 volts, just 50 volts, just 150 volts. Won't really bother.
Just a little shock.
Just a little shock.
Yeah.
Well, of course, the learner was a Confederate, and the learner would make mistakes on purpose. So here's the headline from this experiment. Virtually every person went to the maximum shock place, even though the person on the other side, the learner, was saying, "I'm having a heart attack." Nothing the learner could say could stop the teacher from administering the shock. That it's so illuminating about human nature. All the experimenter had to say is, he was only allowed one phrase: "You must continue."
Hmm.
It's all he could say.
Yeah.
"You must continue." But he's dying over there. "You must continue." So these experiments really helped confirm my belief that human nature is not so okay.
Mm.
And that things like fascism will keep coming back, because every one of those subjects was a proto-fascist, will follow somebody who will say, "You must continue. You must shock them. It's your job." What did every concentration camp soldier say? "Just doing my job."
Mm-hmm. Right.
"Just doing my job." So I'm not sure where I'm going with this, except to say that the literature, the social psychology literature especially, just confirmed my view of from human nature, and just struck me as some of the most interesting stuff around.
Yeah. So to frame kind of what you just talked about, the hardest thing in your life that you wouldn't take back is having these moments of resistance. Yep. In different seasons, it sounds like, but throughout your entire life. Can you explain why that, because you had some time, you said, to think about the answer. Why is that what you settled on as your answer? Why would you not take that back? Obviously, you have a deep conviction for the things that you've fought
really,
for.
It really has to do with World War II. I mean, that's obscure now and far away. But the Israeli phrase, "never again," this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is wrong. And if no one speaks up, what's the famous Edmund Burke phrase about all it takes for,
I don't know,
to go under is for good men to look the other way, whatever the phrase is exactly. It's that idea that lone individuals, I was completely impressed early on at a very young age with the idea of two or three resistance fighters in some cellar in France getting the word on D-Day and popping out and blowing up some train line. That's still the themes of movies. We still resonate with that. We're still connected to that real evil and to what it took. I use as an example all the time of the extent to which we need our life purposes to be more important than the mood we're in. I use which I think is important. People get way too caught up on what mood I'm in. I can't do this because I'm in a certain mood.
Yeah.
Do the stuff, even if you're not in the right mood. But the example I give all the time is, in the days before D-Day, we don't care what mood Eisenhower is in. We need him to pay attention to the invasion. He's a little down, a little anxious. What would he? What we expect him to be? Not a little anxious about where to put 30,000 paratroopers? We'd expect him to be having a lovely day? No, we would not expect him to be having a lovely day. But we want him to get the invasion right. And all of that impressed me. D-Day always impressed me. The idea of tens of thousands of boats and hundreds of thousands of troops being marshaled for the sake of freedom and democracy and all of that mattered to me.
Yeah. So you would attribute that very significant time in the world's history as kind of the catalyst for your worldview, but also the things that you've spent your time fighting for and against.
In which other wars never really registered. Vietnam, I was in the Vietnam era.
Yeah.
I was in the army in the Vietnam era. And yet it didn't register on a kind of existential level, or somehow I knew it was a bad thing.
Yeah.
But it didn't call to me in some way the way World War II continues to call to me.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, among our grandkids, I have a 9-year-old grandson. And we talk about World War II all the time. We'll go, you know, at the Battle of Midway, you know, if that Japanese fighter had been 5 minutes earlier, my God, we'll move things around on a map.
That's probably really rewarding for you to get to do with him.
It is. It's completely. It's fun. It's rewarding, and it's just fun. It's fun, and it continues to be lifelongly illuminating. Just the whimsy of things that 5 minutes here and 25 minutes there matter so much in the course of a war.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, that one little Japanese scout plane had engine trouble and left 5 minutes later than the other scout planes, and it was the scout plane that would have spotted the whole American fleet. It's insane what things rest on.
Man. No, and it, you know, obviously I'm sure the more you study, the more you learn, and the more that becomes nuanced and mind-blowing for you.
Yes.
So when you think about your legacy, because you just described basically a lifelong pursuit. And so when you think about your legacy, you think about your grandkids and how would you maybe tie a bow on the way you describe that to your grandkid, or hope that it would be described maybe to your grandkids or their kids, great grandkids?
I'm not sure if I have exactly the answer to that. This will be a slightly long-winded answer. In my world philosophy, I don't believe there is a purpose to life. I believe we each have multiple life purposes of our own choosing. And I actually believe we need a paradigm shift from that many thousand-year-old metaphor of life purpose to the idea of life purposes. It's a better idea, life purposes. It allows us to think of all of the things that are important to us, not just try to find the one thing that's important, because lots of things are important to us.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's activism or service or creativity or family or whatever it is, many things are important to us. But having said that, even though I believe in life purposes, I do think that we can encapsulate where we intend to stand in life by a single phrase, which I call life purpose statement. I think each of us can create a useful personal life purpose statement. And mine is a very simple one: do the next right thing. So I don't have an answer to the legacy question, but it's something like he did the next right thing, or he did one right thing after another.
That is, so I can't remember where my wife heard that phrase, but she heard it in a book or a podcast or something in the last couple of years. And she really resonated with that idea. We have four young kids, and so she's just in the battle right now, you know? Yeah. And it's easy for her to want to just tap out day in or day out. And I actually was reminding her a couple of days ago, like, she wasn't feeling it. And I said, remember, like, just do the next. And it's amazing how powerful that it's attainable.
Well, may have been me.
On some it's possible. Yeah. I can't remember. To your credit, hope that it was.
And right is an interesting word. I mean, it's a nuanced word. Do the next right thing is a nuanced word, because it doesn't necessarily mean the next ethical thing. It's not right in that sense. It's really more the next appropriate thing.
Yeah.
Given our whole worldview, because the next right thing might be to take a nap.
Yeah.
That might be the next appropriate thing, or it might be to relax in some way. So it's not about doing. By right, I don't mean the next action to take, but more, given one's worldview or one's understanding of life, what's the next appropriate thing to do in that context?
Mm. Yeah. So I want to go back to what you talked about with the religious stuff in your childhood, specifically kind of pushing against it. And I'm just curious to understand your worldview in that regard, and how it was formed so young in you. When you were, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, that the idea that religion was, and I'll use the word religion because I think that's what you used, was this like kind of like false force almost.
Yep.
Like
oppressive and authoritarian and
silly.
I think it struck me as silly, the idea that there was a God who wanted you to have one plate for cheese and one plate for meat. It just, was God gonna care? Given the complexities of the universe about my dishes? I think it just struck me as absurd.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of those, well, really the religious aspect of religion. Practices. Yeah.
Mm. And my mom was a skeptic, so that's gotta count.
Sure.
She lived to about 100, just a few weeks short of 100. So she was let's see if I can get this right. I think 1909 she was born. And in her 20s, which would have been the 30s, she was like one of the first raw food people. And she was already some kind of activist person, or she was just a clerk. She was just a working class clerk, but she was resistant to what she perceived as nonsense, including religion. So I'm sure I got that from her skepticism.
Yeah.
There was no one selling me a line. There was no, you know, we have no idea the extent to which just one person in a family selling the family a line might influence everybody in the family. We have no idea the power of that, but nobody was selling me a line. I think that if you're never sold a line, you're not going to go in the direction of buying things hook, line, and sinker, I would think. But anyway, I think that's probably the single most important thing. And then the second most important thing was, we're now talking about, as a teenager, 47, the early 60s, the existential writers of that time, the Camus and Sartres of that time. And even though I was studying science, I was really more reading existential literature than being interested in science. And so the central tenets of existential philosophy, French existential philosophy of the 60s, was religion was not okay, and take personal responsibility for things. That culture should not dictate. The individual had to stand up for whatever the individual believed in. So the literature, the books I was reading, connected to my core skepticism and reinforced that. I would read books that were, so there are two threads in existential thought. There's theistic existentialism and atheistic. You can be a believer and an existentialist, and an unbeliever and an existentialist.
Yeah.
And the famous books by the theistic existentialists of that time, like Martin Buber, I and Thou, there were books that were, or Kierkegaard is the most famous example.
Right.
He's put in the existential tradition, but of course he's selling religion. And so none of the things said by the theistic existentialists resonated with me. I did not believe that after you've been rational about things, forget that. Now let's take a leap of faith and believe something for which there's no evidence. I didn't buy that idea. That yeah. after having thought things through and decided that likely there's no God, forget about that. Now believe in God. Didn't make sense to me. So I was sort of very carefully culling the atheistic literature as the stuff to read. And I'm sure that reinforced my belief system.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was just having this conversation somewhat the other day, but talking about purpose. Like I'm walking through the death of my grandmother right now and thinking about all the things that she did and pursued that death takes away. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, because I have a very different worldview than you do. Like I'm a Christian. And so we stand on different sides of the spectrum in a way. And I'm curious how you would talk about and understand and coach even people into this idea of multiple purposes. And I think the last question is, you know, if people start to bring in like the religious side of things or not, that everyone's always asking, what does it matter this life right now? Like, that's one of the questions that people are asking. And so from your worldview, how do you process that multiple purposes and arrive at them?
I think there were a number of questions in there. I'm not.
There totally were. I'm verbally processing a little bit, but
yeah,
I think that's
exactly right. Let me tease it apart a little bit. I suggest to all clients that they affirm that they matter and that their efforts matter, whatever their belief system, that they matter and that their efforts matter. I think in every contemporary person, believer or not a believer, every contemporary person has just enough of a piece of the postmodern take on things to wonder if they're just excited matter that the universe could produce and therefore that they don't really matter. So I think everybody has a piece of that, wherever they come down on believing, still that question. So given that question, given that that's a problem for like everybody, that kind of resonance that I don't really believe, I can't quite believe that I matter.
Mm-hmm.
So I want people to affirm that they do matter and that their efforts matter. I invite them to think about that paradigm shift of some singular purpose in life, which they've maybe been hungry for and searching for a long time, to the idea, to the paradigm shift, to multiple life purposes and what that might mean and how you might organize your day around different things that are important to you, different life purposes, and having priorities among them, like maybe your health comes first on a given day or your writing your novel comes first, et cetera. So I have things to say about that. And then I would bring up the other paradigm shift, which is important to me, which is the paradigm shift from seeking meaning as if it was out there to the idea of making meaning, that there is nothing to seek. And that's another many thousand year old metaphor. So people have got it hammered into their head that being a seeker is a good thing. Maybe even a top thing, top tier thing, to be a seeker of the truth.
Yeah.
From my point of view, that wastes a lot of time because it's not out there. That meaning is a certain kind of psychological state. It's a feeling almost. And I have a lot to say about this in terms of what that means. If meaning is a subjective psychological state, what would we expect of it? We'd expect it to come and go like all psychological states. Therefore, when life feels meaningless, don't worry about it. It's going to come back. So that's a very different take on meaninglessness. And you can see that it takes us down roads that I think are very interesting and useful to the individual.
That is interesting to think about the meaning question in particular. I mean, you're right. Everybody wonders, like, what is the meaning that they have?
Where did it go? How did an activity that felt meaningful at 23 feel meaningless today? Or that felt meaningful yesterday doesn't feel meaningful today? It's so interesting because when people sort of get my point of view or think about it, they recognize the stuff that they've always felt, like holding their kid's hand crossing the street is more meaningful than their dissertation was.
Mm-hmm.
Like the stuff that was supposed to feel super meaningful, like getting their PhD, didn't mean much of anything to them. But telling their kids a story at night, that's the real stuff. And so we're trained to believe that the PhD has to be a bigger deal thing than the storytelling, but it's not.
Right.
When we get that the experience of meaning we only experience meaning when we experience it, then that's the truth of the matter. That's when we're experiencing it. And so we get to honor these small meaning events much more once we understand that that's how meaning operates.
Hmm. Yeah, and it gives you, I mean, just listening to you say that, there's a lot more joy to be had,
yes,
in that perspective than there is in a seeking something elusive. Because exactly. I think what happens is you miss all of put blinders on, right?
Yeah, you want to spend 10 years in the desert when you could be rolling around on the floor with your kid? No, come back from the desert and you just...
Hmm.
I have a couple of phrases, meaning investments and meaning opportunities. And there's no guarantee that a thing we're going to do is going to be experienced as meaningful. It's just an opportunity. You know, taking kids to the park, you know, maybe it's going to be a hard day because, you know, they're grumpy.
Right.
Or it's going to be the best day of your life because for whatever reason, they're cute that day. It's a cute day, you know. So it's a different take on meaning. And my bottom lines on meaning is that it's a renewable resource, keeps coming back. So when it is lost, we have to try not to worry so much. And parenthetically, for creative clients, this is such an important point because let's say you're slogging along on a novel for a year, you know, and on any given day, it feels anything but meaningful. What we have to remember is that activities in the service of meaning may not feel meaningful. I have to deconstruct that phrase for folks sometimes, but the headline is, you may work day in and day out on something really important to you, but never get the experience of meaning because it was just sloggy.
Yeah.
It was just tedious. So to get back to your major theme, if you identify something as hard because you're not getting the experience of meaning from it, you've made a mental mistake.
Mm.
You shouldn't need things to provide you with the experience of meaning because that just comes, that's elusive and comes and goes. You do it because it's important to you to do, because it makes sense to do, because it matters, not because you're going to get something from it, namely the experience of meaning.
Yeah. And I think what you're, you know, describing in a way is not living life led by emotion, but instead, or informed by emotion maybe, but instead by conviction.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And without guarantees, it's hard to have conviction when you're not sure that the thing you're doing is genuine. You know, does the world need another, here you're sitting or writing a poem. Does the world need another poem? Can get very confusing because mm-hmm. you can lose your conviction very easily. So a lot of the work that Creativity Coach does, or a lot of work that creatives have to do, is conviction repair.
Mm. That's an interesting phrase, conviction repair. I'm going to sit on that one for a little bit. Well, hey, I want to ask you one more question to kind of wrap up this conversation. Sure. I think we could probably talk a long time, but the question I like to ask is, because this idea of doing hard things isn't limited to a one-time story or an event. It is a constant, ever-present part of life. And so I like to ask, as we wrap these conversations up, what is a hard thing that you're in the middle of right now?
I think it's probably lack of impact for the good work I'm doing. And that's an ongoing hardness, is that I'm not reaching enough people, which becomes its own conviction dismotivator.
Totally.
So I'm not sure if I've landed on the right thing to conclude on, but that does come up for me, is that I know that what I'm doing is important, and Big Pharma has... Does anyone doubt that as you're watching TV, 3 out of 4 ads are now Big Pharma ads? Everything is one drug ad after another. They have billions to spend. And so I'm really a tiny voice, and it's just hard to keep doing it when you understand that your audience is that small.
Yeah. So it's, again, not being informed by emotion, but letting conviction drive your day to day.
Yep.
That is hard to do. It's the next right thing, sounds like.
It's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, Eric, thanks a bunch for hopping on here. I am grateful to get to spend some time with you. I'm sure our audience will be as well. You've obviously been very thoughtful for your entire life. And that's not something that everybody can say. And I think for people that maybe something you said resonated, or they're curious about your books or the thoughts that you have in the work that you do as a creative coach, how can people get connected with you if that's the case?
Sure. The two ways are my website, ericmaisel.com, ericmaisel.com. And folks can email me at ericmaisel. This will date when I first started using email, ericmaisel@hotmail.com.
Well, at least it wasn't AOL. So you're okay now.
That probably wouldn't work anymore, would it?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe not. But that would definitely throw you in that camp. So, okay, great. I'll make sure I put those in the show notes for people as well so that they can find them. And Eric, again, thank you for hopping on and spending some time with us, sharing a little bit of your story. It's much appreciated.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the Do Hard Things podcast by Elite SRS. We hope you are encouraged today and have a newfound hope to persevere. Be sure to subscribe for more great episodes and conversations. And if you ever want to watch an episode, check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/ElitesRS. Have a blessed day.